presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Anatomy of a Movie, the very first show.
Yeah.
That's right. Woo-hoo. We dissect movies. You guys dissect us. Dissecting them, as they might say.
Nice.
I'm your host, Phil Svitek, joined alongside Sarah Stratton.
Hi, guys.
And the only, Dimitri Panos.
Thank God, the only. Hello, everybody.
And, of course, we can't forget Marissa Serafini over there engineering for us.
Hello, everyone.
And, of course, we've got our Technicolor shirts on.
Technicolor.
A, because we are in Technicolor. B, we are dissecting, as you guys can see, for those of you watching, The Wizard of Oz. It is not the 75th anniversary. It's the 75th anniversary.
75 Woo-hoo. Years old.
I know.
Crazy.
And it was just this week. It was really re-released in IMAX, the original, not some remake as they're making nowadays. And we all got a chance to see it.
IMAX 3D, Phil.
IMAX 3D.
IMAX
3D.
All right. Just for future generations, IMAX 3D.
Just tuning in.
For those of you just tuning in, speaking of that, obviously we're going to be talking about the movie, so we're going to be giving away spoilers. But by the way, I mean, if you
haven't
seen
The Wizard of Oz, I was thinking of that driving over going, we don't have to say that, do we? I mean, if
it's
you
a nice
haven't
preface.
Seen...
Some people, they might be like, you know what, I might want this movie reviewed. You know, some yeah. little seven-year-old, you gotta respect the fans.
I understand the seven-year-old if you haven't seen it, but if you're not familiar with The Wizard of Oz...
You're going to get familiar because we're going to discuss it. And by the way, that goes for future episodes, too. Every movie that we do will be kind of spoiling because we'll be going, you know, fully into it. And by the way, you know, speaking of that, we want to thank you guys for those of you tuning in to us that have kind of already been fans. You guys know we've done a beta version of this over at the AfterBuzz TV network. Thank you guys.
Still stealing their mugs.
We're stealing their mugs. We're slowly transitioning to our own sort of podcast network. But for right now, we're still borrowing some stuff from AfterBuzz TV till we become fully our own. But thanks to you guys, you know, it's really for you. And so we're really going to build this out to be a full thing. So really, really excited.
Me too.
But without further ado, let's go see.
Of course, me four.
We're off to see the wizard.
And now, did we get some music?
I'm hoping. There we go.
I want to be the lion.
Because you're cowardly?
No, because I love the lion.
But you have to take its traits, i.e. you're cowardly.
Okay, no.
Or you're curly, dressed as a lion.
All right. Well, Dimitri, I guess, who are you then?
I would definitely be the scarecrow.
Come.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
See,
what about...
You might say, because then you would say... Well, he doesn't have a brain. But obviously, Dimitri over here is like the brain.
Oh, yeah, many people.
I'm the brawn and the bravery.
And you, Marissa?
I would not go with the main character. I would go with the munchkin because I'm short enough to be one.
Oh, wait right till you on. Hear about my stories about munchkins.
And I guess that makes me Dorothy.
Or Toto. Or the Tin Man.
The
Why
tin
not the
man?
Tin Man?
Toto's our mascot, Sparky.
Sparky, Toto. And Sparky is Toto.
I think you could be Dorothy. Let's just put it into a wig.
I think it could be the Tin Man.
All right, so let's get into it because this is, by the way, this is going to be one of the hardest movies to dissect because there's such a rich history to it. There's so much mythos already just, you know, through so many generations. There's so many generations of people, you know, my generation, the older generations, and then I mean, I've met Jerry Marin, and you know, and people still recognize him to this day as the Munchkin Man.
Yep,
you know, and so it's bizarre how this has evolved.
It's America's fairy tale. That's what it is. I mean, we get most of our other movies, whether it be Disney or Pixar or whatever. A lot of them stem from the Grimm fairy tales or things that have been passed down through other cultures. But The Wizard of Oz is an American fairy tale. I feel like we as a country own it, and that's why it connects with so many people. The fact that it's set in Kansas, which, I mean, I feel like if you're from somewhere else, whoever thinks of Kansas? It's the middle of our country, and that's why, and obviously it has such universal themes that I'm sure we'll dive into at some point.
Yeah, and not only that, The Wizard of Oz was written, of course, by L. Frank Baum, who is an American. And so this is truly an original.
100% American over here. Yep. We're 100% American. All U.S. parts.
Well, not that any of us lived during that time, but like, you know, in terms of the themes, okay, so what do you guys think, what do you guys take away as the themes of the movie?
I mean, first of all, the fact that you don't need some mystical power to control your destiny or the world. It all comes down to just the human is the one who has the most power throughout the film. It's Dorothy, obviously. I mean, we're fooled to thinking that the witch and Oz are dominating everything.
Sure.
But just the simpleness of being a girl gets her through it.
And it is, you know, it's a hero's journey, in a sense. Follow the yellow brick road. You know, and I just have to go back to in saying, yeah, this movie, 75 years of history behind it. After watching it, you know, I was starting to think and break it down, and I sort of was becoming intimidated by the title because there is so much to talk about, whether there are stories, the history, what it meant. For me, it's what it meant to cinema, what it brought to the movies. And I want to ask everybody here, I mean, as I was watching it, I was going, damn, this is the first time I've watched The Wizard of Oz on a big screen. I mean, I grew up watching it on television, and that's the only medium that I've ever watched The Wizard of Oz in. And I've never seen it on the big screen until this past weekend. And I was going, at 75 years, and this is the first time I'm seeing it on the big screen. That sort of kind of hit me. I mean, was it the same for everybody else, or am I the only one that started was their first time seeing it on a big screen?
I've actually seen it on a big screen before. I saw I was lucky enough to see it in a drive-in movie.
That's a big screen.
Yeah, it's a big old screen. And
sneaking in the trunk.
Well, you know, just popping out. No, but it does bring a magic to it. And my favorite thing about this movie is not. Obviously, it had a huge impact on cinema. Yeah. But for me, a great movie is something you can really see over and over
Absolutely.
Again. And that's something that's always stayed with me through. Like, that's what I look for in the movies I love, is that I could watch it every couple months and still be happy. And the fact that I've watched this movie probably at least once a year since I was, like, six.
Yep.
That, to me, is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, growing up as a kid, I used to watch it annually, whenever it was on. And, you know, another thing thinking about when you talk about themes, we've talked about coming-of-age stories, and we've talked about, you can never go back home and things like that, but The Wizard of Oz is about going back home. It's about, again, when you talk about American ideals, back then, it is about the strength of the family, being home, the importance of family and togetherness, and you know, her quest is to get back home. And when she wakes up from Oz, she's like, I never want to leave. I'm never, you know, I don't want to leave home again. This is where my heart is. You know, starting off as wanting to be somewhere over the rainbow and then realizing, yeah, over the rainbow can be a little bit treacherous. It's wonderful and amazing, but being back home with the ones who love you is probably the best feeling in the world. So
it's the idea that the grass is always greener on the other side. You daydream about these worlds, these things happening to you, but in truth, your core is in these simple little towns, and especially when the film was coming out, the core unit, the family values.
Absolutely. And home is where the heart is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also about not wanting anything more beyond your backyard, that whole thing, too. And also going with the coming-of-age story, it's about innocence and overcoming obstacles and hardship, because Dorothy Gale's family, it looks like they really didn't have a lot other than the family values and whatnot. And then she realized all the scary things and people out there, and she overcame her fear, and then that also just leads her into adulthood and the realization of, oh, the world is a scary place.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's so true, and just taking one step beyond that, too, when you compare The Wizard of Oz to today, and we talked about this as being a coming-of-age story, in a sense, I think the argument can be made that back in 1939, Dorothy Gale is in today's world, almost like a Katniss Everdeen. I mean, she does
From the Hunger Games.
From the Hunger Games. She invokes a revolution by killing the witch. Everything in Oz changes.
She becomes the hero without setting out to be the hero.
Right. And, you know, she's on a quest. Now, there are major differences, I think, that the Wizard of Oz... Well, from the book, and I think there are major differences, too. I only wanted to make that one small comparison. For the kids who are watching today, who may not be so familiar with The Wizard of Oz, you know, you can trace it back. You can trace certain influences back to The Wizard of Oz and Hunger Games, I think. The argument can be made to a certain extent that it could be influenced by The Wizard mm-hmm. of Oz and revolution and setting aside evil and oppression and all that. No. So, you know, it's sort of interesting how you can still relate The Wizard of Oz today to a modern day kid.
Another aspect of Wizard of Oz that's a little different than some of the films we say is a lot of the powerful, well, all of the really powerful changing figures in The Wizard of Oz are female.
Mm-hmm.
Glinda, the Wicked Witch, and Dorothy are the ones who make the biggest impact through the film. Obviously, like the Tin Man, Scarecrow, the Lion, all the Wizard are huge characters, but in causing change, they don't make as much of a difference.
Sure.
So really the power lies with the women.
And even Auntie M, sorry to got you off there, because Dorothy's always one, like, I want to go home to see Auntie M.
Right.
So she was a driving factor mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, she's an anchor. In a sense. Yeah. I mean, it is Auntie M that later on in the film that Dorothy sees in the witch's crystal ball as the anchor, because Auntie M is calling her back home. Where are you, mm-hmm. Dorothy? So, I mean, women make an impact. And Dorothy is a strong woman or a strong teenager when you break it down. I mean, she goes to run away, you know,
For
the love of her dog. But also she wants that adventure. She asks, may I, Mr. Marvel, mm-hmm. can I come with you? I want to see all these wonders of the world. And, you know, she ends up going back home, but then she ends up on this this wonderful, beautiful land of Oz. And she is hurled off into yet another adventure. And she takes this journey and she does it on her own. And with like verve, and she has courage. She has all of the attributes that are supporting cast, Scarecrow, Tin Man, and the Lion. She has all of those attributes in which she shares with each.
And teaches them.
And teaches them.
Grow through her.
Mm-hmm. How to think out a problem, how to have a heart and be compassionate, and how to overcome your fear and be courageous. And that character of Dorothy Gale, when you look at it, and you look at it as an adult, these are things I never thought of watching this as a kid, but when I'm watching it again, I'm going, yeah, she's going on this journey, and yeah, she's very courageous doing it, and it's a scary world. So I think she is a great role model for teenagers, and she does it without a crossbow. Hey, yippee.
She does it with the power of song.
There you go.
Power of song and dance.
And ruby slippers.
You know, and one of the things I want to kind of, you know, we'll start transitioning into kind of how this was made. And I definitely, you know, you brought up a good point, Dimitri, of, you know, what it meant at the time. And so I want to get into that. But real fast, I want to say that it's interesting, you know, in today's day and age, just culturally, right? How many times you're not in Kansas anymore? And how many people use that?
There's no place like home.
No place. Yep.
And it's interesting to me because I think... the weight that holds for most people, they're just referencing it mm-hmm. without really knowing the history, you know, and what that fully means. And so to them, it's just a simulacrum. And so that's why I do want to go back to the time of sure. what did it mean? And by the way, Dimitri works for Technicolor.
I do.
So what better man to take us back on this?
I will do my best. I think, you know, I do work for Technicolor, and when I go out and do presentations in front of fine folk and managers and theater owners and such, one of the things that I say is that I work for Technicolor. You know, we invented color. And we did for the cinema to a great extent. I think The Wizard of Oz is definitely one of those movies that it changed the way people watched movies. And there aren't, when you look at it, when you look at a timeline, and I have a timeline here, when you look at the timeline, there are there was only so many things that changed. Like in 1893, you had Thomas Edison. He invented the kinescope, and that's the little round thing, and light shines through it. It's like
you would have seen it in Oz, Great and Powerful.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so he invents that. So that's the first time that we see like a moving picture. Then in 1895, we have the Lumiere brothers,
Yes, Stills of Horses.
Stills of Horses. And they created in Paris the first so-called film festival. And even to another extent, another thing that they're really known for is they made a very simple film. It was basically a train arrives at a station.
Yes.
And legend has it, and it all depends on who you read, you know, when this basically was a camera set up at a train station with the train coming in, and legend has it that upon first viewing, people actually jumped away. That, to me, that changes cinema because that changes the technique. It's foreground, background, still shot, you know, and it did so much. And again, it all depends on who you read, but I like to be of the fantastic when it comes to movies. I like to believe that people got out of the way. It's the first time you ever saw that. So then you go to like something like 1902, where George Millais, most famous for releasing A Trip to the Moon, which if you saw the movie Hugo, it was focused on A Trip to the Moon. And this was, in a sense, the first time color was used because this guy, like, hand-painted his frames. And I'm proud to say, it's a Technicolor plug, that Technicolor fully restored, and you can find this on YouTube and technicolorfoundation.com, they restored A Trip to the Moon to a beautiful luster, and we worked with Martin Scorsese, and we gave him the original Trip to the Moon. And that changed the way that people saw movies. And again, your silent film era was born, and you had Charlie Chaplin, you had Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Valentino, you had everything from comedy to drama, all set with the Birth of a Nation. It was huge, and narrative was beginning in motion picture history, and long narrative. These movies are about an hour or so long, and they had live musical accompaniment. Now, I don't know if you've ever had, if you've ever been to a silent movie, with musical accompaniment, it's actually sort of kind of cool. I saw a lot of Buster Keaton. There used to be a great theater on Fairfax called the Silent Movie Theater, and it was on Fairfax, and that place is, I saw a lot of Buster Keaton there, and they had live musical accompaniment. I saw Freaks there. I saw Phantom of the Opera with the original ballerina sepia-toned dance scene, and Carla Lemley was there. So that was all of the age of silent film. And then, of course, you know, our things changed again in 1927 when Warner Brothers proclaimed, wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. And the Jazz Singer brought sound to movies. And if you watch The Artist, you know, The Artist is about what happened during that era. When talk and sound was introduced to movie, it changed the way people saw and now heard movies. But it changed the industry. People were losing jobs. They weren't accustomed to acting through dialogue. It was all through emotion and everything, but it changed the industry.
The talkies, right. And yeah. Another good movie that depicts that is also Singing in the Rain.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people look at singing, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people look at it as, you know, if they're not too familiar, it's a musical. And it is. It's a fantastic musical.
Amazing.
I think it's one of the best movies about the Hollywood industry made. I really think it's fantastic, and it says so much, and it's a beautiful film to watch. Then you get into 1935, where Technicolor introduces the three-color process, and it was on a movie called Becky Sharp. Now, it wasn't a huge film, and it was the first time that this process was being used, but then something awesome happened in 1937 that Technicolor was involved in, and again, it changed the way people watched movies. It was the premiere and the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first fully animated color motion picture, 1937. They had the premiere at the Carthay Circle Theater, and this is the movie that Walt Disney became synonymous with. And because of its success, we have Disney
It opened so many doors.
Oh, it was huge. And then, of course, we go to something like 1939, which many claim to be the best movie going year ever in the history of cinema, which includes The Wizard of Oz, which, again, took that three-color process. And I can only imagine when I was watching Wizard of Oz, how amazing must it have been when it went from black and white and that door opened up. And Manischewitz, did color make an introduction? And they knew what they were doing. And it was as if, hey, we're going to make this color movie. They threw in every color they possibly could everywhere. And I just was thinking, again, watching it on the big screen in 3D, going, how amazing must this have been for that audience to see this? Because it just goes from black and white, and it goes, and then it just.
Well, the original, as long as I'm, went from sepia,
yeah,
sepia to color. Yeah. And I believe that was because, just a side note, it was because they wanted to disguise the door. It's a fun fact, so that it wouldn't show up. I think it was tinted, I believe, blue or something. But they used sepia specifically to hide that transition, so it would be just a magical reveal.
Yeah.
And they also used Dorothy Gale as the stunt double. I believe her name was Bobby.
I think you're right.
Yeah, Bobby. And she was Judy Garland's stand-in, and she was actually in a dress that was more tinted color. And then she opened the door, but then she quickly gets out of frame, and Judy Garland steps in with her color dress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just amazing. And watching it on the big screen when that happens, it's beautiful. And I can't even, again,
it takes your breath away with the character.
It does. It takes your breath away with the story and what you're watching. And since then, cinema has changed. I think another major change was, 1952, when CinemaScope was invented. And so your picture became wider, and then 3D was invented. So,
technology also.
Technology changed. But it doesn't, think about, technology changed, special effects changed.
Yeah.
And we could talk about special effects in The Wizard of Oz compared to a lot today. But I think that, it's tough today to be extremely wowed by something that you see. For me, I think one of the last times that happened for me, and don't laugh, but I think it was when I saw for the first time in IMAX and in 3D, Avatar.
Yeah.
It used a new technology. James Cameron filmed it in a completely different way, and it looked so vibrant, and it was huge, and I actually was like, wow, he just transported me to a different world.
But that's why Avatar works. Yeah. Avatar works because it's set in another world that's beyond our imagination. So we can accept that everything's super crisp and super vibrant. And in a way, it's so unrealistic that it is imaginary.
Yeah.
In its realism, it's unrealistic.
Yeah.
And so it works in that movie because of the other world.
But, Wizard of Oz uses... it's called Pandora, and in a sense, Wizard of Oz is the same thing. I mean, she's transported to another world that is supposed to be vibrant and colorful and have its own life and its own topography and geography. Like, we sort of kind of know every step of the way where Dorothy is without being given a map to Oz. We just know you follow the yellow brick road, you're going to get here, we got poppy fields over here. You sort of have an idea in your head that where she starts and where she ends.
Speaking to that, especially the color factor, this was, time-wise, it was right around the time when people were making the switch to kind of go close-up.
Yeah.
And by the way, which freaked out executives for the fact of like, well, I paid for the actor, I want to see the actor.
Right.
But I could see why this movie certainly did it this way, because if you're gonna see color, you want to see the whole land of Oz, not just Dorothy's eyes or face, whatever. And so I attempt you to try to find any close-ups in this movie.
There aren't
full-on close-ups, but there are
not close-ups. Close-ups. Today's close-ups are like your eyes, and then a medium shot is like just the head.
To speak to your point about the society that they develop in The Wizard of Oz, like you come in, and even just the Munchkins, like you can tell that there is this government system in this other world.
Absolutely.
And because of, like, the little details that you do start imagining the layout of the land and how their system works, that's what allowed so many spin-offs and additions and variations of the whole world of The Wizard of Oz. I mean, you have different perspectives out there. You've got prequels. You've got whole different generations.
And while I'm thinking about it, in Avatar, the line, "You're not in Kansas anymore," is used in Avatar. Yeah, of course. So, you know, that's a great throwback.
I think it's used in... They use... So many of the lines have been repeated in other movies, like, "Fly, my pretty flies."
Yeah.
So
many.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing, too, that's really cool that I'm very proud of, you know, again, Technicolor was there. I grew up watching a ton of movies, early 70s and whatever, and I grew up watching Technicolor, and if you watched Walt Disney, even on TV, it was in Technicolor. But when you think about it, Technicolor is so synonymous with this process, with color and making movies. You know, there were phrases built around Technicolor. I mean, L.A. Confidential, Russell Crowe. You know, he's asked, you know, "You understand what I'm saying, boyo?" And he's like, he goes, "In Technicolor, sir." Mm-hmm. The Technicolor yawn. So Technicolor is, you know, you can use the word and people get it. People understand what it is. Yes. And, you know, I'm very proud to work for a company that even to today, you know, we still are looking for new technologies to get film out there, to help filmmakers and to put the best presentation forward. And back in 1939, you know, they did. You can't argue what was done and how it really did change the way people saw movies.
And even which is great. In the release this past week or the re-release, you can see that people are always... People may say, I mean, it's been released year after year. Mm-hmm. But for this one, they went back. They went to the original film. Yep. They got it all the way out of storage. It's the oldest film ever to be put in 3D, I believe.
Yeah, I believe. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they went, but they didn't skimp around.
No.
They went all the way back. They realigned all the film that had shrunk, that had been kept in storage. Yep. And that's fantastic. That shows that they're striving to make the biggest impact on the film that they can.
I agree, and I think they did a fantastic job. And this past year, I mean, there have been some great restorations. I mean, we got to see Raiders of the Lost Ark in IMAX, and it looked awesome, and there were details that I had never seen before. You know, we even got to see movies like Top Gun in IMAX in 3D, and that was a lot of fun. But the time and care with what they did with The Wizard of Oz, I'm telling you, folks, see it. It's only supposed to be around for a week, but you will. It's wonderful.
It's been demanded in the past to come back after releases, so yeah. it could possibly come back again.
And it did well. You know, it did about 2.5 mil.
I think it went up to 3. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it went up to, I think if we look over the weekend, it went to like.
Was the actual 3 mil? Million?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's see, 3,093,998.
Yeah, that's pretty good. And they only played in IMAX licensed movie houses.
Mm-hmm. It was ranked, I think it got 9th on the list of the box office. And it's funny because if you look at the original release, they worked on a $2 million budget and had a $3 million, which of course in like today's times is like...
It would have been a flop.
Like, but money-wise, you know, it's like $40 million, like $50 million equivalents.
Yeah.
Ish. But so it was very ironic to me, at least, that they were both $3 million.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to get into the kind of creation, you know, the filmmaking process for all of this. And you know, for me, I'll start with the screenwriting process. And because to me, what I like about it is nowadays, screenwriting is almost considered solo art. Mm-hmm. You know, unless it's TV. Right. Whereas in the old days, you pretty much had a writer's room for movies.
Absolutely.
You had a group of five, sometimes even five, maybe more people working on a movie.
Look at the credits for Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, that's why, you know, I like movies from the past, and one of the reasons why they really do hold up because of that intimacy, because of like it started with that process, then it went into production, etc. And so, you know, one of the reasons why I do believe this movie holds up among many, many other things is because it started there.
I agree.
You had great writers.
Yep.
I mean, I think that one of the funny things about Wizard of Oz is if you look at its history and all the stories that have come out, the stories, the rumors, the legends, it was a movie built at, in such, like, chaos between the actors, the writers, the directors, the management, everything was in such chaos that I think that it was just destined to be a great movie.
People being sent to hospitals.
It was that crazy and people were still pushing to make it. It had, you know, they knew there was story there.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, though, to your point, today, if a movie comes out and in the credits, there's more than three people involved in the writing, you're like, you automatically discounted it. It's, this movie's going to be crap because they had no idea which way they wanted to go. But you're right. They took care in putting together, adapting, number one, adapting a book, you know, making changes to a book that was a beloved children's book, and how do we change this, and what do we do? And I think plot point wise, you know, when you have, you're right, the creative process with can be equally as great as whether it's solo, because you at least have people to bounce the ideas off of. And if you're talking about plot points, does this work? Does this not work? Or hey, you know, I think that you should change this. And you know, for a screenplay, for an adapted screenplay, it works. It works great, like great.
But one of the biggest
and it elevates it.
One of the biggest switches, and I know Marissa and Dimitri particularly like this, is the Dorothy role.
Yeah,
you know, she was supposed to be much younger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and in the book, Dorothy is actually like 11, 12 years old.
Yeah,
so she is technically still a kid.
Yeah.
But preteen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, preteen.
So, and to pick Judy Garland, who's obviously a bit older than that role.
But she wasn't the initial. But she wasn't the initial. Judy Garland wasn't the go-to gal for this. They didn't want her for this. They were going with that era's number one draw. Shirley Temple. Who had a drink named after her. Mm-hmm. But
and then when Shirley didn't get it, they tried to transform Miss Garland into a more Shirley-esque figure, putting blonde wig on her, putting baby doll makeup.
For fans, why didn't Shirley come aboard? Whose decision was that?
Oh, I want to say I know she was.
I believe Shirley Temple was part of Fox, and I think there was some contractual.
Yeah, she couldn't get out and get on. I believe she couldn't get out or be on loan. And they wanted her for other projects because she was the bee's knees at that time.
Yeah.
Talk about
and
an old
Shirley
saying.
Temple and had more musical movies in her repertoire than Judy.
Yeah,
and her voice wasn't. As strong.
I'm going to say this. We were talking just before we came in here. There's this great quote that I read. First off, this book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz, this came out, I believe, during the 50th anniversary, 1977, I believe. And Al Jean Harmetz wrote this book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz. I got a lot of information from this. It's a good read, great pictures. You know, but there's a great quote in this book in which, you know, that goes, in signing Judy Garland, okay, MGM, and then back in the day, the studios would make contracts where these people would make movies for that studio only, and other deals would have to be made if they were going to go on loan, so to speak. So this quote says, in signing Judy Garland, MGM had bought an extraordinary voice, unfortunately attached to a mediocre body and a badly flawed face. Welcome to Hollywood, folks. 75 years, not much has really changed. And personally, as a kid, I crushed on Judy Garland. I mean, I thought she was an attractive girl.
I feel like when people talk about her and they talk about how beautiful she was, they do refer to this movie. I mean, later in her career, she got flack for gaining weight and Summerstock and yada yada. People would compare that to how beautiful she was in The Wizard of Oz. So it's crazy.
They had to do work. They had to do work. They had to put her in corsets. They had to fix her teeth, so to speak. And, you know, that to me is, you know, it's still relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
Still happens today. And the cruelty of Hollywood, it exists today as well. You know, and the pressures on teenagers back then. Well, look at some of the teens today, you know.
But here's, you know, I think ultimately the joke's on them because, you know, the fact that we're talking about Judy Garland in this movie, you know what
absolutely.
I mean?
I agree.
No Judy Garland,
No Wizard of Oz. No, and it would have been a completely different movie with Shirley Temple.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as adorable as she is, it would have been a different movie. So
It would have felt, I think, gimmicky. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you see those gimmicky movies come out, you know, in today's day and age, and it would have just been like one kind of, you know.
Yeah. Also, it would have just created a completely different dynamic.
Absolutely.
While Dorothy is the leader of her, like, little entourage, if it had been... Surely I feel like they would have ended up being almost like protectors, or you wouldn't have had... I felt like their group was such a fun bounce-off-each-other time. And also the fact that Dorothy has a little bit... I mean, some argue that she has a romance with the Scarecrow, and that can't really happen if...
No, and I think the maturity level of a teenager compared to an 11, 12-year-old... I mean, look, they did... We're talking about Hunger Games... Katniss Everdeen in the books, if you've read the books, I believe she's 15, 16 years old. She's a teenager. She's just coming into being a teenager, and they go with Jennifer Lawrence, who was like 21. So, you know, now I would argue that today that you could have gone with like a Saoirse Ronan or Chloe Moretz to play Katniss Everdeen. I don't think you could have gotten away with going with Shirley Temple from The Good Ship Lollipop to do The Wizard of Oz. I don't think it would have had the same meaning
if Shirley Temple was more a part of it, because this movie was made in 1938 and filmed and released in 1939, the World War II was going on in Europe at that time, and Shirley Temple's movies are known for being with military people, the Navy, the Army, and so she's had a lot of movies like that.
Absolutely.
If I think Shirley Temple had played Dorothy, I think that would have brought maybe war theme in or any military propaganda kind of into the storyline.
But from and I'm going to bring this up from a male perspective, that, you know, as you can like a girl who's 15, 16, it's hard to like a girl who's 11, 12 when you're in your teens or whatever. And Shirley Temple was young. It's hard to, and back then, you're not, it's hard to rally around an 11-year-old. Not that today, I think times have changed, and I think that you can make, you can almost get away with it. I mean, people like Abigail Breslin and True Grit, that was her, yeah. I mean, she's very young, and you believed in her strength. I think today, with today's filmmakers, you can sort of get away with it. 1939, I think that would have been a tough task. I think that would have been hard.
I think that oftentimes, though, even today, it helps to make actors a little older. Like, looking at Katniss, looking at Game of Thrones, the actors that they place in those roles.
Well, that you would have to,
Like, they're all supposed to be, like, 10. No.
And if you read the books... The stuff that they're doing at 10, I don't think people would have latched onto Game of Thrones if 10-year-olds were doing the certain things that they were doing in the book.
I think that aging people does have a right place.
Absolutely. So,
also, I want to go back to Victor Fleming. I want to go back to him because it's interesting. You know, we mentioned him at the top of the show, and we're at a time when. You know, the director wasn't necessarily seen as the main artist of the movie. You know, that came about with the French New Wave and all that. And so, you know, and to a degree, you know, and because of the technique of editing and things like that, it's more like watching a play, and that's what really sucks you in.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I agree. And, well, and I think the other cool thing about The Wizard of Oz is that Victor Fleming is the director on record. He's the director who gets credit, but the movie itself had four directors.
Yeah.
And which is sort of kind of, again, you take that into today's standards, you get four directors for a feature length that's not vignettes. You're like talking like you got some major serious problems. Yeah, you're talking serious problems. And, you know, there it began with like this gentleman, Richard Thorpe, who began filming this on October 12th, and then 2 weeks in, about he got fired, and to this day, it's not really known why he just got fired.
Well, it's like a different take on the story,
and they said that Thorpe had rushed the cast and crew members and whatnot, and therefore affected people's performances and caused a negative atmosphere on set. So Mervyn LeRoy, who was the producer, had him replaced.
Yeah, he had him replaced with a gentleman by the name of George Cukor, who basically the only thing he did was he did new test footage with Judy Garland. He shot her without a blonde wig and different costumes, mm-hmm. and he basically worked for 3 days, and then he was gone.
But that 3 days really yeah. helped take yeah, that blonde
absolutely.
Wig. It was a good change.
Yeah, I can't imagine watching The Wizard of Oz with Judy Garland as a blonde. Oh, I mean, you know, no offense to any blondes out there. I'm just saying, it's not Kansas.
Sure.
Right?
It, for some reason, just works well with the shoes and dress and, you know.
Yeah, and yeah. I think the reason why they originally went with blonde, because that is the portrait of an American woman, especially back in that day.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. It's a great point. You know, but then you get Victor Fleming, who is actually en route to Do Gone with the Wind. And he comes on, and he didn't even want to do The Wizard of Oz. It was basically he was inspired by his two daughters. He had two kids, and they loved and he was inspired by his daughters to, okay, I'll come on board, and I'll take the reins, and I'll do what I can.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong on this, but I think On the Wind was originally supposed to be directed by someone else,
mm-hmm.
and then Fleming started doing Wizard of Oz, and then mm-hmm. also ended up doing
Gone with
the Wind.
George
Cukor, who was doing Wizard of Oz, stepped out of the picture to direct Gone with the Wind.
And then
Fleming let Wizard of Oz to take over Cukor's part in that movie.
I can't even imagine that happening today. Can you imagine that happening today?
I feel like
I've heard of you've heard of directors being fired, and you know, and they'll still get credit because they've done so much. But with four directors, I can't imagine.
You know, it's interesting. The best way I could describe it, it's like sports at the time. You know what I mean? Well, because you basically have you're the studio heads, you're the coach, or whatever the team CEOs, whatever. And you're managing basically players. Okay, well, here's the people I've contracted to me. Okay, well, you're doing badly. You know, well, let's sub you out. You know,
we're calling an audible. You're right.
That's you know, that's what it is. That's what it was. You know, and you know, you that's how you did it.
Yeah.
Whereas today, you know, that system is really not there.
No, that system doesn't work. And I can't with the egos today.
That's what I was going
to say. I can't imagine that really happening, you know. And it's funny because, well, it was also a different style of directing. Again, we were talking a little bit earlier about Victor Fleming. He was heavy of hand, literally, on set. And it was a different time because
I feel like we're going to get a story.
Well, but that great story we were talking about it is the scene where Judy Garland, Dorothy Gale meets the Cowardly Lion. And he comes up and he's like, woof, woof. And he was making Judy Garland giggle. And she would she wasn't supposed to. And she would just started to laugh. And she would have to take a break and go off set. And Victor Fleming, is the way the story is told, he was being patient. But this happened 3, 4, 6 times or so. And finally, like, he just stepped onto the set, slapped Judy Garland in the face, and said, go back to your dressing room right now. He essentially sent her to bed. And could you imagine today? Like, I mean, a Lindsay Lohan may, like, deserve something like that. But, I mean, could you imagine today a director slapping it? She was a teenager at the time, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is crazy to me. But, you know, I'm not forgiving it. I'm not forgiving it at all. It was a sign of that was a sign of that time and the way that movies were directed. And, you know, that to me is crazy.
I mean,
crazy story.
It's added to the list of injuries that incurred on making this film. But I think that also in that scene, she also slaps the Cowardly Lion. That's her responsibility. So I'm guessing that was where the inspiration came from Victor Fleming, being like, "This is what you're supposed to do."
Well, that's a good way to look at it.
That's right.
I actually noticed the laughing because I was watching the movie again last night, and I even said out loud, "She's trying not to laugh." During that exact scene.
Yeah, and
I
so
can see it.
Yeah, and it's just again, it was a different era of filmmaking back then, and Gone with the Wind, to The Wizard of Oz, to the correct. Listen, there were some great movies. Many call it the best year of movies ever. You know, you had Wuthering Heights, you had Stagecoach, Of Mice and Men, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. I mean, you had some of what today are still
some
considered
very good
some of the
book
greatest
adaptations,
movies.
If you really look at
uh-huh.
it.
Yeah.
And but it was just a different era as to how movies were made, and you also get the sense watching The Wizard of Oz that they really worked hard. And they were under some amazingly, like, people wouldn't put up with the work conditions that they were working under, mm-hmm. I think, during, like, A Wizard of Oz.
I mean, I know that they said it was, the lights had to be brighter because of the color. So these actors were working in, like, 100-degree heat, dancing, singing, on top of being in, I think the Cowardly Lion's costume weighed something like 100 pounds or something like that, because it was made of, like, real lion pelt. That in 100 degrees and, like, skipping, I would faint.
Yeah, and poor old Buddy Ebsen, that guy. You know, and again, another great story when we talk about, again, it's Hollywood. Ray Bolger was originally cast as the Tin Man.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to play the Tin Man. He had his heart set on the Scarecrow, and they had hired Buddy Ebsen at the time to play the Scarecrow. Now, Buddy Ebsen, for you folks, he went on to be Beverly Hillbillies, Barnaby Jones. He had a career, but you know, this was going to be a big film for him, and he supported it. But Ray Bolger, like, stuck to his guns. I want to be in The Wizard of Oz, and it came out that even after filming, and Ray Bolger was an MGM contract player, and they say that in the contract that it was signed that it said that if ever there were going to be a Wizard of Oz movie, the animation of the Scarecrow was to be played by Ray Bolger. And, you know, they say that this happened sort of after the filming took place, but Ray Bolger eventually got what he wanted, and Buddy Ebsen was like, hey, buddy, I'll switch. He goes, you know, I know the importance of this movie. And then that poor guy, you know, he gets into the costume, and then, he ends up in an iron lung because...
ironic. The filament. Tin Man with an iron lung.
The aluminum powder makeup.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that's... he wrote a book called... I think it was called The Other Side of Oz. You know, and he goes into detail about that. But...
Well, I believe they had three actors suffer with makeup problems alone.
Yep.
He had the iron lung with the Tin Man, who then obviously he was replaced. You also had... the Scarecrow's makeup made indents into his skin for like a year. And
more than a year.
Or something,
Yeah, they didn't have keels back then.
Yeah, so just the prosthetics
basically
permanent wrinkles. And then also the witch, her green tinted face makeup lasted for weeks.
Margaret Hamilton. Yeah, and Margaret Hamilton was also said she had so much prosthetic on that she was virtually immobile. She couldn't even like go out and have lunch. She couldn't join people.
Liquid diet.
She couldn't even have lunch with people. So again, when you talk about that era, I'm not sure actors would put up with that. You know, the closest you hear is if you're making a Star Trek kind of movie and the people have to be put in makeup as a Klingon or something. Mm-hmm. But even that, you still have a little bit more field of vision and a little bit more mobility.
It even comes down to the Munchkins. They had some prosthetics on, and there were over 100 of them.
124, I believe?
To the point where they had to do an assembly line because there were so many every single day when they applied the makeup.
Although I think we only ever get two voices, actual Munchkin voices. I think the rest were recorded by all other people. But it is, thank goodness that we've made advancements in prosthetics so we can get, so people don't have these injuries as much. I mean, obviously, there's injuries on film.
Sure.
Often including stunt doubles and stunts. But people aren't injured as much by the makeup anymore.
No.
It's a good thing.
No, and I think it's watching it again on IMAX and the great restoration and in the 3D. It is funny to look at the makeup because, you know, and I know that they did their best to restore it. But if you look at old crappy prints of it, the makeup really shows, like, you know, and watching the restoration, if you're looking at the Munchkins, you can sort of kind of see where the bald cap may be and stuff like that. But I'll tell you, I was still more in awe as to how beautiful things looked.
Just observe the color.
Yeah, it was so great to absorb the entire picture for what it was. And even that green makeup on Margaret Hamilton, just fantastic, fantastic. So, yeah. Well, that was great stuff.
We've been talking a lot about picture. Let's move on to sound.
Oh.
More specifically, song.
Music. Which,
Marissa is a... Marissa has such a love of musical theater.
Great.
I did Wizard of Oz, the musical. Actually, I was part of that. So, I love the music in this. Obviously, they're classic songs. One, best original score and best original song. I thought that the music was great, especially during this time where talkies were still kind of new. Yep. They've been around for a few years, but a lot of musicals were still kind of limited in that mm-hmm. moment. And this, on top of being Technicolor, and then adding music to it, it just even upped the ante with this movie.
Sure. It's like they threw everything in at this movie. And you know, the music, as much as everything else associated with The Wizard of Oz, is just timeless. You know, whether it's Over the Rainbow, Follow the Yellow Brick Road, we're off to see the wizard. You know, If I Only Had a Brain, a Heart, you know, all that stuff is just, it's just great. Oh, and the other thing that I love about The Wizard of Oz, again, when you go back to that heyday, it had a score. It had a theme. When the movie opened and those curtains parted, it started off with the suite that included what you were going to be hearing throughout the rest of the movie. And that's what the opening credits were coming up on. It was a suite of music for the for the orchestra, for the score of the music. And that, to me, like, I love that.
And it's part of why it's made such a great transition to stage.
Yeah.
And to the musical environment that so many kids do. Like, I did it as well. And it's because they have that score. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, most people know that they did eliminate some songs. Yeah. Jitterbug was eliminated, but they almost eliminated Over the Rainbow.
Could you imagine?
If you listen to the full, they did take out the first verse. So yeah. Somewhere Over the Rainbow doesn't start with Some Over the Rainbow. There is an additional, like, couple lines ahead of it. Yeah. And so some of it does get chopped off, but luckily, most of it survived.
Yeah, I want to talk about that scene, too, for a second, because, again, just going back to the restoration and that song, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe I was the only one that noticed, but in the IMAX, in the 3D, she's leaning up against a bale of hay, mm-hmm. and literally that 3D was so sharp, like there was like a couple of strands of hay that were, like, sticking out of that bale and stuff, and they looked so... It looked like you could just tear them off. It really, to me, it added to the song. It added to that scene, what that scene meant. And again, it could just be that I'm looking at this movie with different eyes. I don't want to say new eyes, but they're different eyes. The last time I saw the movie from beginning to end, I was a kid. It was well before I moved to California. And like I said, it has been the first time that I've seen it through and through, and on the big screen, it had a whole different meaning for me, rather than what I remember as a kid. And I can have those childhood memories, which is awesome. But as an adult, now I have these new, great, like, wow, that was amazing.
Well, I know that they made an effort, especially in this re-release. They wanted to have the 3D. They wanted to add the crispness. They didn't want to put it in too much. They didn't want that to be the only focus or to seem cheesy. So they would focus on the witch coming out at you mm-hmm. more than the flying monkeys attacking you from all spaces. And, I mean, I think that was based on more of a technical thing where in the original film the monkeys were moving horizontally instead of actually at people. So, but doing this, making that more subtle to, like, affect your experience but not to be your attention all the time. I think that's why.
Yeah, and 3D, look, so long as you have a good story, and I think The Wizard of Oz benefits from the 3D IMAX conversion because it is such a rich movie to begin with. Back then, 3D wasn't even a thought, so they weren't filming it. They didn't have cinematographers. They didn't have people, like, figuring out foreground, background, and how to compose a shot so that it would look great on 3D, but when they restore it, it really does look great on 3D. And to me, detail came out in that movie that, again, when we talk about special effects a little bit, mm-hmm. the matte paintings were gorgeous.
Amazing.
Right? I mean, and to me, matte painting is an art form
a dying art.
It's pretty much gone, sadly, for the most part. And I didn't become really too familiar with matte paintings. Like, you can notice them in a movie growing up, but I didn't really become too familiar with them until Star Wars. And that's where I learned about, oh my God, like, painting on glass and doing all this stuff. But in The Wizard of Oz, it's just beautiful. And it's an artistry. And if you notice, they were using special effects that they're practical effects. There were no computers back then. They had to do everything in camera to the best of their capabilities. And
the actors had to put up with it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did. But, you know, look what it gave us. 75 years later, and I still think it looks fantastic. You know. So what say you, Phil?
About the special effects.
The music, special effects, and how everything lends into,
you know, for me, I'm not very musically inclined, you know, for musicals. Mm-hmm. So, like, for me, historically, I've always liked the story, and then I'm like, all right, fast forward through this.
Yeah. That's horrible.
I know.
That's so sad.
But that's just me. That's just me. Again, I represent 1% of human beings.
I while away the hours.
The Scarecrow flowers. Dance with Dorothy, that's part of story. You need it.
I understand. I've seen the movie. I'm just saying, you know, I will give him so much credit. For me, now as an adult, I'm amazed at the timing of everything, you know, in terms of beats of story. Because they don't get to Oz until about an hour.
Right. Absolutely. You know?
And, you know, if you kind of think about it, okay, like, what really happens in that time? But, you know, they have such, you know, that first hour is filled with those songs, and that's how they fill the space, and you know, you get to kind of know the characters, and so it's really more of a prolonged first act.
Yeah, and then, well, yeah, to an extent, I mean, I think the first act, a lot of it is, you know, in Kansas, you know, you meet Dorothy Gale, and then you're introduced to who are going to eventually become the main characters, you know, but then Taking of Toto. By Miss Gulch.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? And that's a great thing, too. The setup of that whole entire thing. And again, as a kid, it sort of kind of goes over your head. But Miss Gulch is obviously the richest woman in Kansas. She owns buildings, banks.
She owns half of the county.
Yeah, she's that guy from It's a Wonderful Life. You know, she owns the town. She's the richest woman. She can get away with pretty much anything she wants. So if she wants Toto dead, it's pretty much gonna happen. And the Gales can't do anything to thwart it. Now, another thing that I thought was very interesting, when we talk about storytelling exposition, we talk about acts, it's Auntie M. What happened to Dorothy's parents? It's never really explained how she came into the care of her aunt and uncle. Like, we don't know. Yeah. I guess to an extent,
and it's not
it doesn't matter. We don't care. But today, if you were to make a movie, there would be exposition explaining.
It would be one line. One line.
Right. It would be a throwaway line that say, they died in a hay bale accident or something like that.
But going off of that, because her parents aren't mentioned in the book either.
Yeah.
But I think that also goes, I can picture all the Disney movies that we see. There's always one or two parents that are missing, but I find that maybe not having parents would help generate the imagination in people and have that innocence come out.
In a Disney movie, the parents cruelly get shot. or they die, something, or they get eaten by an eel.
They never exist.
Yeah. I think because we can kind of safely think that Dorothy is an orphan, we make it more believable that she would elaborate this huge imagination, this whole land.
Yeah. So, yeah, but, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, but the music tells a story.
I'm not denying the fact.
You know, the music
My preference.
That's what makes it iconic.
I know.
It helps. But, you know, it's funny when you talk about beats. It's really interesting. So, you know, you're introduced to Dorothy. And then it's a tried and true story plot device. She's the teenager. She's got this horrific story to tell. She comes back home. Everybody's too busy to listen to her. The counting eggs, they're doing their farm things. She's like, you know, Miss Gulch is going to, like, she wants Toto. You know, he's going in the garden. And, you know, then you meet all the people who play, like, Scarecrow. I forget their names.
Hulk, Zeke, and Hickory.
So you meet all these people, but yet they can't help her with her problem.
They save her once out of, what, the pig pen?
Well, she falls into the pig pen. And, you know, but when Miss Gulch shows up, it's almost like Dorothy going, I told you, this is what I've been trying to tell you. And then you go from there, and then Toto escapes. And then you go into the next act. She makes a big decision. I'm going to run away. Nobody listens to me. Nobody loves me. And we have to save Toto. You know, and it was an altruistic reason for running away. It wasn't just, they're not listening to me. It's like, Toto, we got to get you out of here, or she's going to come back, and you're going to be dead. I'm going to take the sacrifice. We'll run away. They come up upon Mr. Marvel, which is, again, another great scene, which as a kid, you don't necessarily know what he's doing, like, with her. And he's sort of a fraud. And
a little bit of a crook.
He's a con artist.
But in his way, he gets her to go back. Like, he's like, you know, there's somebody who's hurting for you. Like, you're causing pain, and Dorothy Gale can't have that. And so she decides to go home. And she makes it. He's like, are you sure you don't want to come with me? She goes, no, I got to go home. And he's like, you did the right thing. And she goes home, and it's a twister, and...
twisters are scary. I grew up in the Midwest, and my family and my house have been affected by many tornadoes. It's scary.
How many times have you not been in Kansas?
A few times.
Nice.
But especially in this film, back in this day and age, you know, I think the execution of the twister was very well done.
Yeah, and it was just like... It was like a cloth that they spun around from a...
Yeah.
I mean, I was marveling as to how good the special effect of the tornado, the twister,
looked. And the wind. The wind was very realistic.
Yeah, they had that, yeah. Those wind machines were on, you know, double high. And, you know, so then you have that. She gets in the house. She gets knocked out. But I think it's, again, the humor of when she wakes up and she's spinning around and all these people are like, people in the rowboat, hi. It's like all these people, they have no idea that they're caught in a twister. Hey, we're still fishing. How's it going? But the scene with Miss Gulch and the bike, and then she transforms into that witch. Mm-hmm. Like, as a kid, I remember that was wicked scary. You know, and then the house lands.
I always thought that the point where Miss Gulch turns into the witch, I was like, this is the point where they're entering us.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, they're changing. It changes. Mm-hmm. And sort of kind of a close-up with... With her,
when she's dreaming.
Sort of. They had one, in that big crystal ball. At the M, mm-hmm. I'll get, you know, when
yeah,
they
sort the
of had, I mean, she was in a crystal ball, but I don't know if you can count that as a close-up, but sort of, kind of.
No, I'm going to go home, good old thing. Close-up. Email them to you, Phil.
Okay. You know what? I said color.
You said
close-ups in color.
I'm pretty sure there's one of Dorothy when she's in Oz. I'm sure I can find it.
When she came out of the house, like, you saw, again, I don't know if it was like a, you know, a
Are we just trying to prove Phil wrong here?
No, yeah.
No,
I'm not trying to prove you wrong. Actually, you brought up a point that you're making me think. Mm-hmm. And this is why I love doing this, because we could talk about these movies and everybody can have something that they take with it. And if you bring up a point about close-ups, I would be like, wow, I didn't really notice that. And it makes me go back and then I think about the movie in a different way and try to see, wow, not to prove you wrong, but just to say, wow, I could be saying it to prove you're right. To say, Phil, my head, Phil, that was an amazing observation.
Hopefully.
Oh, God. I'm still looking
for all I know, this movie's just all shot in close up. And every fan's going to be like, what is he?
What is he doing?
Has he seen the same movie? What are your favorite songs? Well, you know, why don't we make it a little personal?
I will always like Somewhere Over the Rainbow. But I mean...
Okay. That's your inspiration.
I was in this as a child. It's like the first big...
Dorothy or no?
I was Dorothy.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, it was like my first like lead role in a play. So I have a connection to Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I feel really awkward right now. Can we go? Yeah, but I just...
Dimitri, were you Dorothy in your high school play?
Yes. Wait, no. Wait, what? No. No. I was the tree. Dimitri. Thank you. I'm out. I'm out. I'm done.
What about you, Marissa?
I would have to say it's a toss-up between two. That Follow the Yellow Brick Road and the Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead. Both, you know, really take place in Munchkinland because those are the ones that always stick with me. They're very upbeat, very catchy, very sing-songy. You can get stuck in your head and you'll never get them out.
That's very true.
They're fun. They're fun and happy and, like, beat.
You know, it's funny that you say Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead, too, because that is yet another phrase or another melody that, listen, if, you know, we've all been in various positions in life. Maybe it's just me. But I don't want to speak for everybody, where you've had to deal with somebody who is not so nice. And if something were to happen, if that person were to leave, you're like, Ding Dong, The Wicked
just
Witch.
Just titling
is dead.
Them as The Wicked Witch is so common.
Yeah, I mean, so. But I think for me, my favorite songs is the suite that, like, with each character she meets, it's basically the same tempo, just played differently with different lyrics. And again, it moves the story along. Mm-hmm. And I just, for a musical, it's a very clever technique. It's a great, I don't know if bridge is the right word for that in a musical.
It's a very skillful use of repetition.
Yeah.
And
the same bar over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So
Makes it easier.
Really,
maybe in production.
But they change it up a little. Like if you notice from the Scarecrow to the Tin Man to the Cowardly Lion, and then it all works itself into We're Off to See the Wizard.
Well, it happens constantly in musicals. Like Andrew Lloyd Webber's famous for using
repetition
and using that to link your characters and showing like the similarities between each one of them through song. Also, it kind of separates them from Dorothy.
Yeah.
In that they're all from this world. They all have this, in a way, melody, and she comes from this dreamy land to intersect with them. So I do like those songs as well. And I have some fun dances.
Yeah, and how about the scene? I believe it was she's coming to where the Scarecrow is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene, and like the Wicked Witch is in the background. She's behind a tree.
Oh, the, sort of the kinda, apple-throwing tree.
Well, no. Before the
That's
apple.
After
well,
the
it's yeah, and it's they're like the. She says she's going to be keeping an eye on her, and there's a scene where she's literally, and it shows her, she's hiding behind a tree, and she just sort of kind of goes around the tree and then away. And you're like, wow, that's like impending doom, impending danger, like what's going to happen? And then she shows up later on in the journey, you know, but the thing with the trees and the apples, I had actually sort of kind of forgotten about that, you know, but that's where, you know, how about a little fire scare, you know, when she throws that fireball at him. Yeah, it's the movie has it. The movie does have it all. I mean, for, you know, it's got music, it has adventure, it has drama, it has comedy. You know, it literally brings everything together, and they really, you know, they throw a wide net to capture as many, you know, but kids can love it. Adults, I think, can love it. I was thinking, you know, go ahead.
Do you think that they release these, you know, every anniversary they do these releases to kind of protect it from being remade again? Because I feel like a lot of classic films are getting debated about to bring in new stars, new actors to do them. And part of me thinks, well, they can't redo it if they keep releasing the original Wizard of Oz. Instead, they have to create these spin-offs.
You know, I mean, I don't want to be cynical here, but allow me a second. I mean, it was a beautiful restoration. It looked beautiful on the big screen. But what comes out on Blu-ray next week in a spectacular reissue 75th anniversary edition, it's The Wizard of Oz. You know, Warner Brothers Home Video really spearheaded this project along with IMAX, but it was really spearheaded a lot by Warner Brothers Home Video. I'm not going to look, it's a great week-long commercial that made $3 million. Usually you pay for your commercials. This one brought in $3 million. It did well enough that it may, you know, stick around for another week. You know, I don't fault them for the way that they've marketed this home video release. Because for me, I got to see, like I said, I got to see this movie with a different perspective, and I was very proud and happy to do it. And again, being a part of Technicolor, I really was extremely proud to know that the company that I'm with has that history within it. And yeah, it was pretty cool. And will I buy the Blu-ray? That's the thing. I don't know. I mean, I might buy the Blu-ray. I'm just happy that I got to see it in the format that they decided to restore it to. And I got to see it the way it is because, you know, we're talking about it now.
Mm-hmm.
This movie's 75 years old.
Yeah, and that's another thing because this movie, it is timeless. Yeah. There's no specific time. It's relevant to any point during the decade or whatever year you're watching it. It still has a good overall message. And the fact that people may not want to do a reboot of this and remake it because, like, all those war stories that we hear about this mm-hmm. movie, it'd all be for naught.
Yeah,
if they remade it.
Yeah, and, you know, Disney's done its, they did their prequel, so to speak.
Yes.
With James Franco, which was fine. You know, it wasn't anything that I'll remember or take with me. But The Wizard of Oz.
I remember Mila Kunis had a very big hat.
Yes.
That's one of my lasting memories from that film.
Yeah.
Very big hat.
Very big hat.
I did like that they included some of the elements that got changed from the book, though. I will give them kudos at
sure.
least in that yeah. movie. They included, like, Chinatown mm-hmm.
or yeah.
whatever it's called. Completely forgetting the
porcelain
name.
Yeah.
Yes, but yeah. they drew from other aspects that sure. The Wizard of Oz, obviously, whether it be time constraints or whatnot, had to change. Yeah. I liked that, but if you're putting the two next to each other, I'm going to choose the original.
You have to, and, you know, yeah, it's... That's just the way it is. It's mm-hmm. the original.
All right. Well, guys, we've been talking for quite a while.
Wait. I gotta tell the Munchkin story.
All right,
because I've been waiting for this. Because this is crazy. I did not know. Now, there was a movie called Under the Rainbow. I believe it was called Under the Rainbow, star Chevy Chase, that sort of kind of dealt with this. It was a throwaway movie. It never was a great movie in which Chevy Chase played a detective. There was a murder at the Munchkin Hotel. Now, the Munchkin Hotel, for all you folks, if you're coming to visit Los Angeles, that hotel still exists. It is in fabulous downtown Culver City.
Did you know that?
It,
I did not.
Yep, the hotel still exists.
But you're from L.A., Sarah. So
I don't know that.
Well,
yeah,
Culver
no.
City.
Yeah,
it's Culver City was Culver City is where MGM was. Had the screenings, and, too, for this movie.
Yeah, and, MGM Studios, which are now Culver Studios, yeah, the hotel, it's right in downtown Culver City. It's right across from the Pacific Theater.
Okay.
And it looks like a wedge. It looks like a wedge. And in fact, they used to have a bar lounge there called Munchkins. And that is where the Munchkins stayed. So that's the hotel, the Culver City Hotel. So it still exists. It's still there.
I used to work cool. like a block from this, and I'm very confused. I'm going to have to like go back.
Yeah, when you say a block, like where?
So Pacific Theaters is yeah. on this side of the street. Uh-huh. If you go down in Main Street, like over here, I yeah. worked right there.
Okay, yeah, it's right across from the Pacific Theater.
So for and those was, you listening like, on iTunes.
Yeah. yeah. You guys got a great visual.
Well, no, I mean, so you look up Culver City. Corner. You can look up the Culver City Hotel. There used to be a lounge in there called Munchkins. Well, in any case, so there was 124 Munchkins, and they were little people. They were midgets, and they showed up apparently to party. They had to put police on every single floor at the Culver City Hotel due to wild parties and sex orgies. Okay, which cracks me up. But wait, they had to have like showgirls who were filming. They had to be escorted in bunches and by armed guards off the lot because of these people. There is a legendary story, apparently, that during the Christmas season, as the story goes, there were three prostitutes who moved into the hotel, and there were lines going down the block. And I'm like, oh, it like, I can't. Watching the movie and looking at these Munchkins,
they're supposed to be so sweet.
We represent the Lollipop Guild. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a lollipop? That's what they were trying to figure out at the Culver City Hotel. I mean, that cracks me up. Like, that
I'm
is gonna crazy.
I'm going to continue to picture them as innocent, sweet, Munchkin horny. Lads.
Horny.
No, like,
horny. Horn dogs. And hence the term Blumpkin was.
I would say that my favorite legend
This is what we're ending on.
No, no, I'm not willing to be that.
Please don't.
My favorite legend is that while
the dead munchkin hanging in a tree?
No. Oh. That is a swan or something from the zoo.
But it was a legend.
Swan.
But they were thrift shopping for costumes.
Yes.
And they picked up a jacket. I can't remember exactly which character wore it.
It was the wizard. It was
Professor Marvel.
Professor Marvel. Yeah.
And he pulls up in the pocket. And whose name is sewn in? But the author of the original Wizard of Oz. And that story or legend has been confirmed, I believe, by his widow. So I will take her word, and this is true. And that's just wonderful.
I like orgies with midgets.
No. The jacket.
That just cracks
the
me.
The author was present in the making.
It all comes full circle.
Thank you.
It does.
And what about you, Marissa? What's your favorite tale? Myth, legend, truth?
Of Wizard of Oz or just...
no, Hunger Games. Hunger Games. We're talking about Hunger Games. We've been talking to Hunger Games, Marissa.
Yes, I've been aware. But no.
It's awesome.
I do like the whole jacket. I thought that was really interesting. I never heard of that, so I think we should end it there.
Right on.
There you go.
All right. Well, fans, I know there's so many stories that we could be. We might as well be here for 75 years. That's the history that this movie has, and we're never going to be able to cover it all. Don't judge us. I'm sure you. Why didn't you talk about this?
This was a great movie to kick off Anatomy of a Movie.
Yes.
I think it was a great movie. I like to say, I think we all did a good job.
Yeah.
Round of applause, everybody.
And rate and comment, fans.
Yeah,
let us know how we're doing.
What we should do next.
Yeah, we'll be doing some movie. We've got the Halloween season coming up.
Gravity is coming up.
Yes.
Can we do something happy? I like happy
Thanksgiving.
Ones.
Well, you've got Thanksgiving and holidays coming up,
Yeah, I like holidays.
So, you guys are going to get Halloween.
I do want to.
I've got my Halloween costume plan.
Listen, I want to utilize. I just got in today. I know this is off topic, but I just got in today the anniversary edition of Halloween. And for us to watch it in a screening room together and look at that movie is a classic. That movie is fantastic. And we're talking about, I'm telling you, like if we're going to. Yeah,
I can't watch scary movies, you guys. I'll embarrass myself.
This is a good one. This is a good one, and it doesn't fall into the gore. But listen, we have October's a big month. We still have Rush is coming out. Which
Sarah's
was
excited.
Oh, we've got Don John coming out.
Coming out.
Yeah, the Counselor. Yeah. We've got.
We could still do The Prisoners.
Yeah, we could. Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
That one, yeah, we can do The Prisoners. Listen, I'm telling you, the other one, Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, fantastic. So
and that's just October.
That's
yeah,
October.
Yeah, we have our holiday.
Oh, goodness.
Thanksgiving.
I know, Thanksgiving.
Dimitri, you and I.
Oh, man,
planes, trains,
and
automobiles. And the Addams Family. We decided to do that as well.
Oh, the Addams Family. It's a good one. And
values.
I also like
Addams Family
Before.
Values.
I also like Nightmare Before Christmas.
We're going to do that as a Christmas movie because that's a Christmas movie.
And when we get to Nightmare, we got to talk about the merits of it as a Halloween movie and or a Christmas movie.
No, it's a Christmas movie.
Because I go
Halloween. I would agree.
I think
my Christmas movie list is really intense where I watch basically
intense.
A movie a day.
Oh, really?
No, the month of December,
yeah.
I have so many traditions that it's just built up a really long list.
Yeah.
Like from old school, like Babes in Toyland, through Nightmare Before Christmas, through all of the Santa movies.
Uh-huh. Yes.
All right, so a lot to look forward to.
A lot to look forward to, folks.
Thank you guys for joining us. Thank you guys for being here. Hey, on behalf,
I do have a question. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Did I have to answer for me?
Well, I guess, or anybody who can, if people were to write, what do they write to?
info@anatomyofamovie.com.
Okay.
.com.
Anatomy of a Movie.
Info@anatomyofamovie.com. And where can we find all you?
Nowhere.
Yeah, do we have...
You can find Sarah on the AfterBuzz TV Network, recapping Boardwalk Empire soon. Dracula?
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. No.
Dimitri.
Trekboy1701a@gmail.com.
All right, and you can follow me on the AfterBuzz After Shows, Glee, Once Upon a Time, Parenthood, and then you can find me behind the booth, engineering all the other ones.
And so
on Twitter, @SerafiniTV.
Nice. And where can people, is there a website for?
We're building the website. If you're listening to this now,
yeah,
the website has been built by the time you're listening to this. But it has not been built by the time you recorded this. So you're watching amazing
basically,
time.
Live on tape.
Look for it soon.
Okay.
Yes.
We're building slowly but surely with your guys' support. Thank you, guys. We'll see you
here
for the next
movie. Next movie.
Garo, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff. We would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.